Yeah, thanks everybody for being here, and thanks to Peter and Yuan for organizing the this great workshop, which I'm really enjoying, and B, inviting me. When I sent Peter and Yuan my title and abstract, you know, I don't know what you guys do, but whenever I send out a projected title to abstract, it's sort of wishful thinking, you know? It's usually not work I've actually done yet. It's work I hope to do, maybe eventually after the meeting. So I gave the title, The Influence Adaptive Movement on Coevolutionary Dynamics, and I'm not going to be giving a full rendition of this, because it's an enormous, enormous topic. But I will be giving you some sort of steps towards this. And at the outset, there are various people I've worked on related topics over the years that have been very helpful to my thinking. I'll just acknowledge them, including Richard, who's in the audience. And the outline of my talk is, I'm going to start out not with just sort of abstract theoretical things, but why should we care? I would argue that the topic of this workshop isn't relevant just to basic ecology. There are many important questions in applied ecology. And what I'm going to talk about is the issue of whether or not biological control is evolutionarily stable or not. So I'm returning to an issue that I published on about 10 years ago. And I'm going to make the proposition that when you tie together spatial heterogeneity and unstable dynamics, that you can sometimes decouple the ecological impact of a natural enemy, such as a predator or parasitoid, from its evolutionary impact as a selective agent acting on properties of its of the victim species, and that adaptive movement can influence this in various important ways. And I'll touch on coevolution right at the end. So, as I said, why do we care? In addition to these basic issues, adaptive movement may have really important applied implications and sometimes help explain puzzles in the world. And the puzzle I'm going to talk about has to do with an interesting pattern that's out there having to do with the contrast between biological control and chemical control of target pest species. And by control, you mean the reduction in average abundance of a target species after imposition of a control measure well below the carrying capacity it would have exhibited otherwise. So like Q equal average or equilibrial density in the absence of in the presence of the control agent divided by carrying capacity. You want that to be a lot less than one, you know, if you're trying to get rid of, you know, the boll weevil or whatever. So biological control is the control of pests through the use of organisms that are natural predators, parasites, or pathogens, right? Versus chemical controls, where you apply pesticides and you kill them directly. And so in this paper with Mike Hochberg that I published a little over 10 years ago, I pointed out that there was a very interesting contrast in the world in the seeming evolutionary responses of the target pest species to these two kinds of control. So if you look at pesticide resistance, you can come up just like that with hundreds to thousands of examples of the evolution of resistance in the target species that's been effective enough to lead to a breakdown of control in nature. So some insects, like the diamondback moth, are now resistant to all known chemical pesticides, and they're, you know, it's very difficult to control them. But it's actually much harder to come up with clear-cut examples of the loss of control, that sharp limitation in numbers, in biological control. And nearly all the examples you can come up with are like myxomatosis in rabbits in Australia. They involve internal pathogens versus parasitoids or predators. So like I said, that was my sense of the state of the world, you know, a little over 10 years ago. So one thing I did last week was I contacted people who were in that world, people like Matt Thomas at Penn State, Alex Cragel and Charles Godfrey over in England and so forth, and said, does that still hold? And it apparently still is still a robust empirical prediction, but it's the kind of thing that's really hard to nail down quantitatively. Just like a lot of things we know are true about the world that are sometimes really hard to actually put a number on, like adaptive radiations are more common on islands. We know that's true, but actually when you try to quantify it turns out to be difficult. But if you look at what appears to be the case, the number of cases of evolved loss of control follow a clear pattern. There are a lot more cases of chemical control than any kind of biological control. And for biological control, pathogen control, you find more evidence of breakdown of control than for parasitoids and predators. And it's very hard to find any examples for these. Yet you would think naively or at first glance that there ought to be really incredibly strong selection going on when you impose a biological control agent that hammers the target species. There's a massive change in the selective environment as well as the ecological environment of that species. Why don't you see a lot of evidence for breakdown and control? So let's assume the pattern is real, and then we can ask questions, why does it exist? Okay? And back in that paper, I rephrased it a little bit here, I suggested that there were five possible reasons for the evolutionary stability of biological control. I'm going to walk through these and then focus on two of them. Two of them have to do with genetics, lack of genetic variation and constraints on selection. And then three of them have to do with ecology and organismal differences, having to do with the fact that biological control agents have their own population dynamics. Chemicals don't. They're more passive. Both predators and prey, parasitoids and their hosts and so forth, have behavior, including adaptive movements. And of course, you can have coevolution between a control agent and a target species. So let's walk through these. Lack of genetic variation. The most direct explanation for absence of evolution is that you have no genetic variability in a species upon which selection can act. Now, that may be true sometimes, but we know that when you look in detail in the lab at traits that you think might be related to evolved resistance, as in the work of Charles Godfrey and Alex and Drosophila, you usually find some genetic variation. And it's very unlikely this is explained it across many species. And why would there be that kind of difference between chemical control and biological control, right? We have no a priori reason to believe there'd be that kind of difference. One genetic thing that could matter, though, is that maybe genetic constraints are more likely for the evolution of resistance to biological control agents, things like predators, you know, coccinella beetles, than to chemicals. So let's look at the chemicals. A lot of chemicals operate on a sort of lock and key procedure where there's a particular physiological pathway that's disrupted by the applied pesticide. And maybe all you need is a single small change in the enzyme and that insect or the other pest species can counter that. And there may be very few genetically correlated other traits that are related to that particular genetic change. Versus if resistance to, say, a predator requires you to change how big you are, where you hide, what time of year you come out, anything like that, Those are massive changes that are correlated with a lot of other fitness components. So there could be a lot of cost to resistance to biological control agents that are not so evident for chemical control. Okay. Now, what about population dynamics? Well, the whole point of biological control is to impose a natural enemy that keeps the population well below carrying capacity. Well, we've had a classic problem in population ecology for a long time, which is how do strong, you know, you've got a problem, because almost all predator-prey, host-pathogen, host-parasitoid interactions tend to be unstable when the natural enemy is very effective at limiting that species' numbers well below carrying capacity so that its own intrinsic density dependence is relatively weak. Okay, and so then we've had a, you know, large cottage industry in ecology trying to explain how you can explain the persistence of these seemingly intrinsically unstable interactions. All right, so, and that's something obviously you don't have with chemical control. You don't have that inherent instability in the system. You can have very effective chemical control, and there's no problem with instability at all. The most general mechanism out there is spatial heterogeneity. Things like metapopulation dynamics, refuges, adaptive movement among patches that vary in quality, and so forth. And so one of the questions I'm going to ask is, when you tie together this intrinsic instability that natural enemy victim systems have with spatial heterogeneity, how does that affect evolutionary dynamics, and particularly the response of the target species to that natural enemy, and then what is the role of adaptive movement in that? And Mike, the conjecture that I will be exploring with you is that there can be kind of a decoupling of predation as a factor that ecologically limits prey numbers or parasitoid limiting host numbers and so forth, and its effectiveness qua selection, qua natural selection on its prey. And sometimes, at least, this decoupling between the ecological and evolutionary impacts of natural enemy can be enhanced by adaptive prey movement. So the kind of models that I've looked at to look at this question of sort of coupled population evolutionary dynamics fall into two simple schemata, and I'm really only going to talk about one today. Modules are when you have more than one species. So I've got one pop. So now we're looking at just the host. If I had the parasitoid, watch it, Matthew. You ought to be glad your talk was first, buddy. So this is a flow through time. So it's not a food web. You got to read the slide before you make wisecracks. So this is generation T, and this is generation T plus one. And here we have a scenario where there's a sort of at the beginning of every generation, there's kind of a well-mixed pool that then gets divided up between a refuge and a non-refuge, exposed, epsilon E for exposed, okay? And then there's reproduction, there's survival, and then whatever comes out gets mixed up into the next mating pool, and they do that every single generation. So you can imagine, you know, butterflies flying around, and the females depositing eggs onto different host plants, okay, some of which are exposed to parasitoid, and some of which are protected because of the quality of the host plant relative to the parasitoid. And then when those that survive come out and they enter up at that same generally mixed butterfly pool. This is a lot of interest here. It's simpler, and there are some extra complications. I'm not going to have time to talk about it. The other would be if you had separate sort of habitats in space that were partially coupled each and every generation. Okay, you have more dimensions here, and you know it's interesting. But much of the same things I'm saying here apply here. The difference is now you can get sort of the evolution of separate gene pools, which is not the case over here. Okay. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to try to really simplify things. Rather than talking about complicated models, I'm going to talk about really simple models and try to abstract some conceptual messages from those models. And I'm going to start with a host a target species that's initially in demographic equilibrium and also in an ideal free behavioral equilibrium, which remember means that fitnesses are equilibrated across space. And then after you impose the control agent, you assume it moves quickly to a new equilibrium, which initially would be just demographic, but then it ultimately might be a new behavioral equilibrium. And then we're going to assume the control measure is what we mean by refuge, is that's an area where the prey is protected from the control agent, okay? So what do we got? So here we have our little model for our host, say, and remember we have the number of individuals settling into the refuge is a certain fraction of the number in the initial generation. The number that are outside are the rest, okay? And then of all those that settle there, then they compete, they reproduce and so forth, both in and outside the refuge. And then that's our little iteration over time. To complete this, of course, we'd have to have a model for the natural enemy as well. But let's just look at this for a second, since we're really interested in this question of the evolutionary stability at the moment of the world from the host point of view. For demographic equilibrium, we know that, you know, this got to be true. Average fitness has to be equal to 1. And for behavioral ideal free equilibrium, you have to have fitness equilibration across space. And because fitness has to be equal to each other and the overall fitness has to equal 1, then the fitness in each habitat has to equal 1, right? And when you go through a few lines of algebra, that means each pet to equilibrate that its respective carrying capacity, which is simply defined as that population size, taking into account all density-dependent factors in the environment, where each individual leaves one offspring behind. And then, for that equilibrium to hold, there has to be something that's true, necessarily, about the fraction of individuals that are exposed to the outside environment, which is the relative carrying capacity of the exposed environment versus the total population. So now, given that we have a system like that that's in equilibrium, before we've instituted the control, how does evolution influence the ability to utilize the refuge and exposed habitats? And what we do is we imagine that we introduce a clone that has a little bit different fitness in each of the two habitats, and we just want to know, can it increase when rare? The dynamics of the invading clone are thus, so that in the refuge, maybe you change the fitness, either positive or negative, by a small amount, and you do the same thing outside. And if you assume the resident clone is at equilibrium, the fitness of the invader is simply this weighted average of the fitness decrements or increments in the two habitats, where the weights, and this is where adaptive movement starts coming in, have to do with the movement rates among the habitats. Okay? So here's our little algebra, you know, for the logic of selection in this system. So how does control and adaptive movement influence the rate of increase of something outside the refuge? So imagine initially that movement rates are fixed. So we impose the control measure, and you know, there's been some kind of evolutionary equilibrium in the original ancestral environment that's defined the movement rates, but initially there's no change in those. Okay? But there's this, because you're having this necessary averaging across habitats, you know, you've got the question of how does, say, an increase in your fitness here because you're able to avoid the parasitoid outside the refuge, what is the cost that carries back here? Well, since I've already just said that there's no effect on movement, I'm going to change that assumption in a second, we could ask the question, if you compare chemical resistance, given what I said earlier, to biotic resistance, and if chemical resistance is relatively cheap usually, okay, then all that matters is that you have a positive effect upon fitness in that area where you're exposed. And if it's cost-free, you always expect in the long run that it'll be selected for. However, if there's cost that goes with it, whether or not a particular mutant can increase when rare, even though it would allow you to escape better the natural enemy outside, if it's too costly in the refuge, it won't be able to spread. Okay, so it's possible that even without considering shifts in movement and so forth, because of this difference in the genetic architecture, as it were, and correlations among traits and so forth, that we could explain the difference between the breakdown of biological control due to chemicals versus the absence of breakdown for biological control. But now, let's assume that movement rates are labile, i.e. they can change either over relatively quick evolutionary time scales or behaviorally, okay? You know, an insect recognizes it can smell a predator in its environment that's similar to some predators it's been exposed to in the past. And now let's assume again that the movement rates lead to a new equilibrium both demographically in terms of the ideal free distribution. And that control is very effective. Remember what we mean by control being very effective is that the new equilibrium population size outside the refuge is way below the population size that you expected in the absence of the control agent. That's what you mean by effective control. So what is the new ideal free distribution across those two habitats? Well, for there to be that ideal free distribution, the movement rate has to decline to a level that's determined by the magnitude of the control in this habitat. So if you have very effective control, very few individuals ought to be out there, okay? So now we look at this novel mutation that could increase your fitness were it outside the refuge, and you say, well, there's actually few individuals out there, so when you average over both habitats, what happens to that mutant is determined almost entirely by its increment or decrement in fitness in the refuge itself, i.e. what happens outside becomes dynamically irrelevant. So the fate is determined by the impact on the refuge, not on what happens outside, okay? So the net effect here of adaptive movement is to remove the population from the environment where selection would be exerted on this population and therefore make it less likely you will see evolution by natural selection to withstand that control agent. So just to repeat what I just said, an increase in predation combined with adaptive prey movement, at least to an ideal free distribution, should reduce the fraction of the overall prey population that's exposed to predation. This reduces the force of selection for escaping predation, and this could contribute to the difference between chemical and biological control. I haven't said anything in the last few moments that would separate those two. I mean, you'd expect exactly the same thing for chemical control and biological control. But there still might be biological reasons, organismal reasons, to expect a difference. Most chemicals that are imposed upon target species will be novel things they've never seen before in their environment. Okay? Now, when you introduce a coccinellid beetle, They're probably, most of these target species have encountered in their evolutionary history predators, parasitoids, and pathogens. And if there's some commonality in responses, behavioral responses, say, to whole suites of natural enemies, then maybe you would see a more rapid readjustment of movement rates for relative to biological control agents than to chemical control agents. At least that could be a working hypothesis that people could look at. Okay? So for this to work, this conjecture would seem to require play to more effectively distinguish refuge versus non-refuge habitats in biological control than chemical control. So what about population dynamics? This is all assuming that everything settled down to a nice demographic equilibrium with an ideal free distribution among habitats. And I think that's a very useful place to start, but we can't end there. So maybe what you see with, say, a host parasitoid system is that the impact of spatial heterogeneity leading to refuges is that you get persistence that's not a point equilibrium but some other kind of attractor. So I'm going to look at a particular example here and ask, what are the implications of unstable but kind of bounded dynamics on evolutionary dynamics, okay? And I'm going to use a particular model that I and various other people looked at. We've talked about the Nicholson-Bailey model, the host parasitoid system, before. And this is what's called the proportional refuge model. So here's the host, here's the parasitoid, and each generation, remember, there's a fraction of hosts that get exposed to the parasitoid. And these are the fraction of hosts that survive, and of those that survive, they reproduce at a certain rate. And of the ones that were protected, they're not exposed to the parasitoid, they're reproducing, but maybe at a different rate inside the refuge. And so this equation in brackets here is the per capita fitness measure for the host. And then here's the parasitoid recursion. Out of each parasitized individual, of whom there's, you know, this number, a number C parasitoids emerge. So initially I'm going to just look at this with what happens with a fixed movement rate, i.e. a fixed fraction of individuals found in the refuge each generation. And something I did a long time ago with Mike Hassel over in England was to look at this proportional refuge model when you had heterogeneity in the quality of the refuge for the host. And what Mike had done with Bob May earlier was to look at this same model but assuming equal growth rates in the two habitats. And it seemed like there was sort of a narrow zone of parameter space that allowed stability of the system without it either blowing up the host go extinct. But if you allowed there to be different growth rates inside the refuge and outside, it turns out this is for fixed movement rates at 50% here. So these are refuges that are sinks. Okay, basically for essentially any value of growth rate outside the refuge, the sink stabilized this proportional refuge model. I was trying to think if there were any undergraduates here. They were probably still in diapers when I did that paper. But so here's just an example of how you get bounded S oscillations that aren't getting too extreme in their values in the proportional refuge model. Okay. So now we want to know, how does this kind of unstable population dynamics affect adaptive evolution across the two habitats? And we're going to look at what's called the strength of selection on each parameter in turn. So here we have our equation for fitness, the bracketed term here. And what we do with the strength of selection, the basic idea is you say, what would happen if you were to introduce a clone that has, you know, you start with your ancestral parameter value and add a little bit to it. Would that increase fitness or decrease fitness? And what's the magnitude of that relative to the change in the parameter value? So for a stable population, what you do is you just take the fitness expression and you take the derivative of that with respect to the parameter value, and that gives you a measure that you can compare among parameters then for which ones are most sensitive to selection. Okay? And then you can do the same thing. Now that's what we do. That's a standard protocol for stable populations. Find a lot of examples in the literature of evolutionary ecology that do that sort of thing. What about unstable population dynamics? Well, what do we know from an ecological point of view? If we have populations that are in discrete time, okay, so we're not talking about complicated age structure and so forth, and remember, we're not dealing with individuals that are discrete here, so everything's expressed in sort of a continuum. So the numbers are big enough, you're not worried about demographic stochasticity. So there's variability, but it's not stochastic variability. So if you have an unstable persistent population that fluctuates between bounds, and every generation this is its geometric growth rate, then you know that its long-term growth rate, if it's not blowing up to infinity or going to zero, has to be about 1. Okay? And so what we can do then is we can take a resident clone that's unstable and fluctuating, and remember the host is fluctuating, along with the parasitoid, let it run, say, 10,000 years, and then introduce a very rare clone with a little different parameter value, and just watch its fate over time. What is its geometric growth rate relative to the resident type, given that it has, it's always so rare that it doesn't perturb parasitoid numbers. So what, and then it turns out then, so then you take the derivative of the geometric growth rate with respect to parameter, conditional on the long-term geometric growth rate being equal to 1, okay, and it turns out to be a very simple formula. It's the, in each generation, what is the sensitivity to fitness to the parameter in that generation divided by fitness in that generation. And then you average, you take the arithmetic average over time of that expression. Very simple form. And what this means is that, because remember, if things are fluctuating, their times fitness is greater than 1, and times it's less than 1. When it's less than 1, those are the times that get exaggerated in terms of how natural selection will average the fate of that clone, depending upon the fate of its, you know, what its effect upon the parameter is over time. So selection is being weighted towards generations that have low fitness, at the expense maybe of generations that have high fitness. And so now I want to do this for the proportional refuge model as a numerical example of what of the really interesting effects that emerge when you have unstable dynamics in a system like this. So now we're looking at the strength of selection on the host in a relatively mild sink where the geometric growth rate in just the sink alone is 0.9, in the absence of the parasitoid outside it's 4. And then this is the solid lines are the strengths of selection on each of the parameters were the population to be at its equilibrium for the, you know, in the system. Okay, so we're looking here at the strength of selection relative to the attack rate, to the ability of the host to further increase its basic birth rate outside the refuge, and its basic ability to increase the birth rate inside the refuge, with all the other parameters being fixed. So I'm not looking at kind of at the moment at trade-offs between parameters. And what you can see here, this is negative because from the host point of view, you're always to have selection on the attack rate, you always want to reduce the attack rate. So you have a negative strength of selection there. And the more exposed you are, the stronger that selection ought to be. Okay? Because more of you get exposed to the parasitoid, therefore you ought to be hammered more, and selection ought to be more effective at retaining alleles that reduce the attack rate. But the other thing that happens as you increase exposure here is that you start destabilizing the system because there are fewer individuals that are found in the refuge and the inherent instability of the Nichols and Bailey start kicking in, okay? And what you can see here is that as you destabilize the system, you start weakening the effect of the strength of selection for the host to reduce its attack rate. This becomes even and this shows the instability here in terms of this is the so down here is the stable region, and then this is a coefficient of variation of host as it gets less and less stable. Okay. This is now a poor sink, which tends to be much more unstable, and the effect is now quite radical indeed. Now, as you increase the fraction of the host that gets exposed to the parasitoid each generation, the strength of selection is effectively 0. Okay. On the ability to escape the parasitoid when you're outside the refuge. Right? And so if there's any trade-off between that and, say, your ability to use the refuge itself, you're very unlikely to see selection. So as a way of sort of seeing why that works, okay, why you have a weakening of selection as you have increased exposure of the species and system. Remember, the dynamics are getting more unstable the more exposed hosts become to the parasitoid. Let's go back to this expression, where this is now the sensitivity to selection of the geometric growth rate to a particular parameter, and we're just going to assume that the system's kind of cycling between really high and really low parasitoid numbers. Well, really low parasitoid, before you have a geometric, so you've got a one fitness, a lot of fitnesses are well above one, and a lot of fitnesses are way below one. And basically, you can throw away all the terms where fitness is way above one, and all you're left with are the ones that have high parasitoid numbers. So the fitness when parasitoids are abundant, this goes to zero, and all you're left with is this. So the attack rate and the growth outside the refuge are basically irrelevant to the fate of a new clone that arises, and that's what this says in terms of the strength of selection upon those parameters. Okay. So it could be that the reason biological control is unstable is that the reason it persists is that there's spatial heterogeneity like refuges, but that it persists and there's still unstable dynamics, and the net effect is that when you look at how selection averages over different habitats through time, that selection is automatically biased towards what's going on in the refuge at the expense of outside. Therefore, the predator is an effective control agent ecologically without becoming an effective selective agent evolutionarily. So one thing we've been talking a lot about was movement rates itself and adapted movement. So how does unstable dynamics influence the use of the refuge itself? Well, we've already seen that if you're going to have much in the way of movement, you've got to have some instability in the world. So if the system is stable, most of the time the use of the refuge is maladaptive, but instability does favor some refuge use. So I conducted pairwise and three-wise competition among clones that differed only in their movement rates among habitats. And so here we have all possible parameter space. Remember, because it's a discrete generation model, you can have nobody moving, everybody moving, everybody exposed, nobody exposed. And then up here, above the line of slope equal to 1, you're competing a clone that has a high exposure rate to a clone that has a low exposure rate and seeing who wins. And so down here, the clone with the higher exposure rate wins. Up here, the clone with the lower exposure rate wins. And here, you get coexistence of the two. But then if you, every time you have coexistence, you allow another one to be put in that's in between them. One of them gets displaced, sometimes both of them get displaced. In the long run, and this is kind of adaptive dynamics, some of us are doing adaptive dynamics before the word was around, by the way, if you go back and read the literature properly, you end up with an ESS, evolutionarily stable refuge use, which is a certain fraction, and this is only because you have instability in the system, okay? So this is with a mild sink, but, you know, up here is sort of a high growth rate outside, and here's a lower growth rate outside, and so forth. So back to adaptive movement, per se. So I did this a few years ago, okay? And so, but this was for, you know, what happens with fixed movement rates. You can then say, well, what happens if there's behaviorally labile movement? And so what I've done for this conference is assume that the host use of the refuge depends upon how many parasitoids are outside the refuge. But basically, you know, clearly if the host were completely optimal, you know, there would be some generations, if you have unstable dynamics, when they would all move to the refuge, and the next generation, the parasitoid would go extinct. So that's not very interesting. So I assume that there's a minimum exposure to the refuge that you're kind of constrained with, but given that constraint, you know, we have a logistic term that basically determines how exposed you are to it. And this parameter here is just what is the parasitoidity at which both habitats have equal fitness, so you ought to have equal use of both habitats. So first, how does this movement rule influence the ecology of the system? And then secondly, how does this movement rule influence how selection is operating in the two habitats? Okay. So this is a different example, but this is without, so this is a fixed equal habitat use with a mild sink, and you get unstable but bounded dynamics. We have now kind of a weak switching response, and the magnitude of the oscillations becomes less. We have a stronger switching response here. It's now stable, but I should point out, and I haven't fully explored this, this kind of outcome can depend upon where you start. You can get alternative equilibrium in the same system. then you make it really strong, and you set up a new kind of instability, this time driven by the very rapid behavioral movements. And notice the periodicity here is periods are much shorter than in the previous kind of population-driven periods, okay? So I was thinking about this, and there may be, if you have time series, there might be signatures of when these behavioral dynamics are important and when they're stabilizing in terms of the periods, because, you know, there's a rule for, you know, sort of like 4 to 10 times the generation length is kind of a rule of thumb for what you get for periods and host pathogen, host parasitoid, and predator-prey systems. It's often much more rapid for these sort of behaviorally driven instabilities. I don't know anybody's tried to look at that. So this is what that stability diagram I showed you earlier. You know, as we start making, you basically make it harder to control the host, and you just sort of shift these stability domains. You know, and this is all kind of. So here we have an example with a somewhat moderate switching rate, and there's actually two zones of instability surrounded by with it bracketing a stable parameter space. But then this is what happens to selection. And before I show you, here's what happens to the actual dynamics. So you look at average host numbers and the coefficient of variation in host numbers, which is the measure of variability, okay, as a function of the magnitude of the switching parameter, okay, going from no switching to very rapid behavioral switching between habitats. And here we have, it stabilizes, okay, then it becomes unstable. And when it becomes unstable, this particular example, it kind of levels out, okay, with this amount of variability in host numbers, which remember, it also leads to variability in parasitoid numbers, which leads to variability in fitness over time. And this is now the strength of selection, using that protocol I was talking about before. And as the system gets more stable, this is now, selection on the attack rate per se. It's getting more negative, i.e. selection is more effective at capturing an allele that reduces the attack rate by a little bit. But once it becomes unstable, again, you weaken selection on the attack rate per se, okay? The sort of qualitative shifts in the strength of selection as you go from stable to unstable domains. This shows what happens with a very harsh sink where, you know, there's a huge fitness difference between outside the sink and inside the sink. And here, you tend to have just, except at really low levels, a lot of variability in host numbers over time. And again, the strength of selection on the host to reduce the attack rate is very weak. Okay, and now another thing I decided to do, this is all looking at it from the host point of view. We can do exactly the same thing from the parasitoid's point of view. And that's what you need to do if you're going to work up to coevolution between them. Okay, this is now the strength of selection for the parasitoid on the attack rate for different values of the host's sink. And notice the numbers here, if they're sort of on the same scale, these are all numbers, you know, 0 to 0.2 and so forth. These are much higher, i.e. the strength of selection on the parasitoid, even taking into account that numbers are fluctuating and so forth, are much higher on the attack rate than similarly the strength of selection is on the host. And this is particularly, sometimes they're really huge effects. And again, this is going from stable dynamics to unstable dynamics. And there's a qualitative shift in how selection is likely to be operating as a function of the stability of the system. I might point out, you know, that Richard Dawkins, in a paper with John Krebs some years ago, talked about the life dinner principle, you know, about why asymmetry and coevolution ought to be in the direction of the prey species versus the predator. And the life dinner principle is that, you know, you've got a fox chasing a rabbit. The fox is going for its lunch, the rabbit is going for its life, right? However, in this case, if you have refuges in the system, most of the rabbits may be actually protected inside the refuge. And the fox, if it's only eating rabbits, it's going for its life too. And most of the rabbits don't even see the fox, okay? So that's sort of what's going on here. So I'm going to conclude, so we have time for questions. And my first sort of general proposition, which I goes well beyond the details in this talk, is that I think population dynamics, whether or not populations settle into an equilibrium versus showing fluctuations that are bounded through time and so forth, can have very large impacts upon evolutionary dynamics. And that's a theme that's been barely touched on in the literature of evolutionary biology and evolutionary ecology. With respect to the issue that I started with, unstable dynamics tend to sort of focus host selection within refuges. When you think about how natural selection is sort of averaging in a complicated way what's happening over different habitats, you know, I've already argued that adaptive movement in a stable environment will often lead to moderation of the force of selection, because adaptively, as many prey or hosts will avoid that selective circumstance as they can. That means that anything that would come along genetically that it can, could improve adaptation is likely not to be captured by selection. Okay? And that this kind of diminution in the force of selection due to natural enemies is aggravated when there's unstable dynamics. Adaptive movement, I think, can have complicated effects, and I think we've already seen some examples of that in this workshop, you know, where sometimes it stabilizes, sometimes it destabilizes, depends upon the details, and so forth. But at least sometimes when you tie in adaptive movement to this sort of stuff, it leads in the same direction. So I would argue that unstable dynamics and adaptive movement by host in heterogeneous landscapes may help weaken evolutionary responses and targets of biological control. And this might help explain the paradox that I started with, not paradox, puzzle really, of why you seem to see much more evolutionary stability in biological control relative to chemical control. So there's some open questions here, obviously, many open questions. One is, I haven't said anything about predator, you know, what counts as a refuge from the predator's point of view? Is that responsive to them? And what about coevolution per se, where the attack rate ought to be a joint function, say, of phenotypic traits in the predator and its prey, or the host and its parasitoid? Well, I thought I would have answers for this workshop, but I didn't. Thank you for your attention.
Can you tie in some of the ideas, or would it be possible to tie in some of the ideas here with some that refer to evolution of resistance in antibiotics? And
absolutely.
The appropriate time course.
Yes.
Of antibiotics.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. The evolution of resistance. So maybe possible to artificially sort of generate these cycles that you would get in your host parasitoid system, so as to minimize them.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. You could do that. And you know, when I said that chemical control, and that would include antibiotic control of a pathogen in an individual host, has no dynamics, that's actually not quite true, because you know, for antibiotics, there's a schedule of delivery of the antibiotic, right? And how lousy the antibiotic is. You know, the other thing that you have to remember here is that all these are deterministic results, and what you'd really want, if you're trying to eliminate something, you want it to go extinct, which means you have to start paying attention to demographic stochasticity, which goes beyond these sorts of models. And remember also that I had refuges here. Okay, if you took out the refuge, then what I said about, you know, unstable dynamics leads to weakened selection doesn't work. You could have very strong selection then. So in terms of antibiotics within the host, it might have to do with, does the bacterium or virus have a refuge where it's not doing much harm? Because remember, if you're going to have a refuge, the sort I'm looking at, it's a sink, so its lambda is less than 1, but is that where selection is sort of concentrated, okay? Sometimes that's true and sometimes that isn't true, all right? Does that help? And there's a literature out there on evolution of resistance to insecticides, too, and a lot of it, too, boils down to how you want to have sort of refuge populations for the target species where you don't apply the pesticide. It involves different biological mechanisms than I'm dealing with here, because you know, if you have a sexual species, you can have gene flow from one population into another population, and then if you have maladapted individuals mating with relatively adapted individuals, they drag that population in the direction of the maladapted population. That's a different mechanism than here. I'm talking about stuff that applies for clones, like bacteria. Okay. That's a great question.
And,
that was a constraint here. I mean, I basically assume there's a refuge that the parasitoid just can't get into for whatever reason, or the predator's too big to enter these little crevices where the prey is hiding out, or something like that.
So it would seem like from if you didn't have a total constraint, that would be the direction the predator would try to move.
Maybe, but remember, when the predator itself crashes, the host then can grow outside the refuge.
That's not clear.
So the question is, it's not clear until you work it out. That's right. That's right. Exactly. Well, if you think about the red scale system, I was going to look up the details on this because I thought of that exact example, but there is a refuge. There is a refuge. It's kind of in the interior of the tree, and Priyang and I were trying to remember just yesterday why the parasitoid couldn't get in there. But like 90% of the... Okay, so they've got protection from some other species then, right. Right. But a majority of the hosts are often found in the refuge, okay? So they're relatively, so if you think about how selection averages over what the conditions are in the refuge and what are outside, selection is automatically biased towards the environments that are most often experienced by individuals in a stable situation, okay? So if there's an ideal free distribution of that host, probably isn't, but if there were, then I would argue, you know, it makes perfect sense that selection would be biased towards staying really good at the inside the refuge, even at the expense of your ability to deal with that parasitoid outside. That's consistent with the evolutionary stability of that demographically stable biological control system. I couldn't hear you because of a Peter. Oh, that's right. So I'm not claiming that this model works for that particular system, but I'm just saying if you look at that same model, regardless of the details, if you imagine that the red scale were coming up into one population and splitting up and then recongealing along the lines of this model, then most of them are found in the refuge, relatively few are outside, and that would automatically by itself lead to this kind of bias. I don't know. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that'd be really fascinating for somebody to look at and see if there's any obvious evolution going on in the host species to the parasitoid. Who's in charge? I think John's in charge of picking out the... Insights? I have speculations. Clearly if you have multiple natural enemies that are operating in different ways, you could imagine that if you think about the ability to, say, resist attack as a trait, but there's an ability to resist a predator, there's ability to resist your pathogen, there's ability to resist your parasitoid, and if all of those are sort of quantitative traits that are correlated, it could be the fact that selection is going on them all simultaneously, and that's weakening the overall response to selection to any one. So a suite or ensemble of predators might be much more effective at maintaining evolutionary stability of control than any particular species. I think that's at least a plausible idea. Now, that wouldn't work if it's a suite of predators that are all acting the same way, okay?
Okay. It's just the lunch dinner. Sorry, life dinner.
Lunch life. I call it lunch dinner. Maybe I'm hungry.
I tend to cringe a little bit, but not, I guess not shudder when I hear that thing because.
Notice I was debunking it, wasn't I?
Well, I hope so.
I hope you understood what I was saying, Jim.
Within this group, right, that it's a tie, as best I can tell. I mean, one way to say it is, you know, at equilibrium, birds equals deaths, and if birds are coming from food and deaths are coming from the predators, that it's a tie. And when people hear this, of course, it's a little different from John, but when people are saying it tends to suggest that somehow death is more important than obtaining food or it should dominate or something.
Yeah, but that's not what I was saying.
Right, okay.
I was not saying that at all. In fact, I was arguing the whole point of this was that the evolutionary bias may be in the direction not of the host, but of the natural enemy.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so this is officially a good crew to probably people will appreciate that it comes right. The calorie and death.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
Oh, we'll come back to you.
Okay, so I was wondering, in your opinion, what additional insight can be gained from extending this model to a basically cognitive model? So for instance, I know that there's a
It's a two habitat model, spatially explicit, but the world's simplest spatially explicit model. It's a lattice of two cells, okay?
Yeah, it's very successful. I mean, in biological system, the PT part where, I mean, they have a refugee, the field of refugee.
Exactly.
Slow down the resistance.
Right, but that's what I was saying in response to, I think it was Mark's question, is that the difference there when you're talking about the models are sort of, they're diploid, they're sexual, they have to do with gene flow swamping selection, which is different from the kind of arguments I was doing here, which is the logic of selection per se when gene flow is not swamping selection, okay? Because these are applying to clonal organisms. The BT systems are all applied to sexual organisms. And that's great. I mean, that's not a criticism at all. It's just that this is a different line of argument that leads kind of in the same direction. Well, what you do have, I mean, the refuge, it's remember, but each generation in this particular model, the population mixed up again and then it redistributed. So you can say that you have other ways of classifying the population into mutually exclusive categories. And if some of those categories are rare, then in fact, selection is weak on them. That is, in fact, an old argument in the evolutionary literature, though it's very sub rosa. You have to identify it. The first person I know who explicitly said it was Lee Van Valen talking about the evolution of some human traits way back in 1962 or something. But that's right. You wouldn't have to have space, but here I was talking about space. So if you're talking about adaptive movement, you almost have to talk about space.
Okay. How about one more comment?
That's right.
In a very similar way.
Exactly.
To a spatial refuge. So you can think of instead of being in a refuge versus being outside the refuge, you can think of being in some sort of state where you're not moving around as much.
Right. I mean, let me point out one other place. This same kind of logic comes up that's more familiar to people, maybe. That's in the evolutionary theory of aging, okay, where it's all based upon how the strength of selection declines with age. And the reason the strength of selection declines with age and age structure life history is that you have fewer old individuals than young individuals. There's a demographic asymmetry in the world, i.e. any gene is more likely to be expressed in a young age class than an old age class, and after the age of first reproduction, there are lower reproductive value. Those two things tend to go together, okay, in age structure. And so that's actually the same kind of argument, because they're, you know, at any given time, any individual falls into one of several mutually exclusive age classes. But then the ones that are rare in the population are those that are discounted by how selection is acting, averaging over the entire life history. So it's a similar kind of logic underlying that as to what I'm talking about, really. Okay, but I'm just doing it in space. Okay.
Thank you, Bob.
Thank you.